We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. We are, I believe, one member short of a quorum this morning. We have some people that have checked in and already gone across the hall to Public Safety or another committee. So we will wait on approving the minutes from yesterday. And we will jump right into the agenda. And we'll start off with Representative David's bill, House File 122. Pinch hitting, and we very much appreciate that, pinch hitting for Representative David's is Representative Atkins. Representative Atkins, if you want to move House File 122, and let's get into it.
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. We're just going to the consent calendar, is that right?
I believe so. And we're going there with the understanding that the author and the chair and the temporary author and all kinds of interesting people will continue this work in progress.
Look at your committee administrator, Mr. Chairman.
I know. I heard consent calendar. I know.
There were a whole bunch of people that grabbed their left arms. And
I know. That's why I was looking tingling. Straight this way and not watching any heart attacks happen.
We'll move it to the general register, Mr. Chairman. And the I did note that only Representative Murdoch and I got the Mr. Murdoch's or Representative Murdoch's memo for the day, but y'all can catch up later. Representative Davids, I believe, had a wedding or something to attend this morning, and he was unable to join us.
He actually wasn't attending. He just had to get up at 4, and he was going to make crumpets and things. So,
doesn't he do that every Friday, Mr. Chairman? This is a good bill that is getting even better, as Representative Davids would say. We are seeking peace in the valley. It's my understanding from the parties, and I'll let them explain their positions, but that they've made steady progress that gets us almost there. And there is an assurance from, from me as the temporary author, but I think Representative Davids would say the same thing, and the advocates would as well, that the remaining points that haven't been worked out, they'll continue to work on before the bill comes up on the general register. It's not going to come up on Monday or Tuesday or anything like that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to my all-star witness, Mr. Spizzetto, and he can walk you through the bill, and then we'll take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Representative Atkins, and I will probably say this again at the end, but I do appreciate all the parties in this getting together and working this, and I know we don't have peace in the valley yet, but I very much appreciate, and the committee appreciates, everybody's willingness to get together and make this a work in progress. So thank you all very much, and Mr. Spizzetto, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dominic Spizzetto, I'm representing the Minnesota Dental Association. And I'd like to thank the chairman and my temporary author for helping us move this bill along in our 11th hour. And we are, again, as he said, searching for peace in the valley for Representative Davids. This bill attempts to address concerns that the Dental Association has had about recent developments in contracting with dental plans and dental organizations. There are three basic issues in the bill, and I'll run through them very quickly. The first is the first three sections of the bill deal with contracts, their renewal, and their amendment. This is a fairly important issue because the dental contracts, most dental contracts, and those particularly with Delta Dental, the dominant carrier in the market, basically are evergreen contracts, which means once you sign the contract, it's in force till the dentist chooses to terminate or the dental plan chooses to terminate. There are various mechanisms in which the dental plan will amend the contract by changing their rules and procedures, but the basic contract says, I, Dr. Spizzetto, agree to be a participating provider in this plan and deal with all the rules and procedures that you have for your dental providers. So we, the first part of the bill would authorize contracts to exist for 3 years. It would require a renewal after every three-year period. And the reason this is in the bill is we don't want to make more work for dentists. We don't necessarily want to get into a lot of contract disputes. And candidly, the dentists, as individual businessmen, have very little authority to negotiate with any of these large carriers. So it's really not going to change the face of the contract. But what it would do would be to assure that these changes that we're seeking in the other sections of the bill would then apply to existing contracts that are already in force. And the only way to do that would be to end those contracts and start with new contracts through a renewal process. So that's why that provision is in the bill. The second major issue has to do with audits, and these are conducted mostly by Delta Dental Plans of Minnesota. For many years, Delta Dental used to use what was called a prior authorization procedure. So Mr. Atkins would come into my dental office, and I would look in his mouth, and we would see a tooth that was cracked, and we would take an x-ray, and then we'd fix it for him, we'd put on a crown. We would then submit that information to the carrier, Delta Dental, and they would approve it and say that it is a covered service, and they would even indicate what the patient would pay and what the responsibility was for the dental plan. And that was a fairly cumbersome procedure, frankly, because it had to go through every time there was a treatment, there had to be a prior authorization. So several years ago, Delta decided that this was cumbersome and very expensive, and that they were approving 99.9% of what was coming in anyway, so this was superfluous and a costly issue. So they got rid of it, and there was happiness in dental land. Several years later, though, they started to do what we refer to as post-treatment audits, and that is based on information analytics that they would review based on a dentist compared to other dentists, and maybe even for a particular procedure, they would say this dentist was out of line. They would come in, do an audit, look at records, and determine if the services were covered or appropriate, or if there had been adequate documentation, if they were necessary. For a variety of reasons, they could say that, no, we didn't think this was appropriate, and then they could withhold money from the dentist as they went through this process of auditing. This is probably the major piece of the bill, and this is the one that we've had the most discussion on. I want to be very clear, we are not trying to eliminate audits at all. We think audits are justifiable. If there is fraud, we don't want to protect anyone that's committing fraud in the state, and we understand that these audits are necessary. All we were trying to do in this legislation, in this section, was to give the dentist more protection, make it a fairer process, more equitable. We wanted to do things like limit the time periods in which certain things could be done in terms of lookbacks for auditing procedures, give the dentist an opportunity to make sure they understood their ability to mediate or go to arbitration, and in some cases hire a lawyer to dispute these audits. But as I said, we have reached some consensus on several parts of this piece of the legislation, and there'll be an amendment forthcoming shortly that will take care of those. It is our intention, if we were to reach total consensus with full peace in the valley on this provision, that we would remove this section from the bill entirely. And that is based on the offer by Delta Dental to include this in their next rounds of contract amendments. So in that way, we would get around the worry of having to renew contracts, just so we could make sure that this would apply to all our dental members. The third section of the bill has to do with non-covered services, and this is a proposal that was actually passed by your committee last year. This version is a little different. This is a national effort around the country to address an issue of contracts where a dentist may be required to cap their fees for services that are not covered under the plan. There are several types of dental services, and many of you probably realize this from your own dental plans, that are considered cosmetic or not covered, things like veneers or certain types of crowns, or if you want something special done to a tooth. Those types of things are considered cosmetic. They're not covered by your dental insurance, but yet we want to make sure that entities, dental plans, don't come in and say we'd also like cap fees on those things, because frankly all that is doing is cost shifting on to people who don't have those services, such as all our elderly, since they have no coverage under Medicare. So we think this is an unfair situation for both the dentist and the consumer. We will be offering an amendment that incorporates language that's been adopted by NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators. It's model legislation, and as I said, this is a national movement. To date, there are 20 states that have passed similar legislation like this, and we would hopefully move forth and be the 21st state. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the description of what's in the bill. We do have an amendment that perhaps my temporary author would move, so we could put the bill in the shape that we had agreed to so far during our process.
I think that's probably a good idea. Let's move the amendment.
I think we have a quorum now, Mr. Chair. Is that
I don't know that we do right now, but we did at one point. So we are now legal.
We're all
so.
Good. I'll move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins moves the A2 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Why don't we vote on the amendment, and then we can talk about the bill and the deal that's still a work in progress, but what we've got so far. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Thank you, gentlemen. And do we have anybody else that wants to come up and testify for, or anybody else, somebody from Delta want to come down and talk about their perspective? Mr. Lally, please proceed whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joe Lally. I'm Vice President of Delta Dental. With me also going to testify today is Dave Morse, who is the President of Delta Dental. I think we want to give some context to the bill. We think, as we talk on behalf of the 1.89 million Minnesotans who get their dental benefits administered through Delta Dental, we're concerned about any limitations on our ability, on their behalf, to recoup funds paid to dentists, which were for services that were provided, and for upcoding and for other issues. I think it's really important to put the contract piece in some context. Right now, dentists do it. We have evergreen contracts with dentists. Those evergreen contracts permit the dentist at any time to give 90 days notice and withdraw from the network if they don't like the changes to policies or procedures, if they don't like reimbursement, if they just want to do something different with their practice. And so that voluntary piece is already included in the contract. The first portion of the original bill, not the amended portion, but the first portion of the original bill is contrary to nothing short of the federal and state constitution, which protects impairment of existing contracts. We think our agreement that has been discussed by Mr. Spicetto in part goes a long way to say, you know, we don't have to change existing contracts at all. And we're willing to make some changes to accommodate some concerns of dentists, and we're glad that we can have some agreement on that. We don't have agreement on the whole bill, and we hope that we can continue to talk about that. The big piece of the bill is on audits, and we need to give some context to those audits too. During the 7 years in which we've conducted audits of dental practices, we've collected more than $5 million from dental offices and returned that money to the state in public programs, to the state in terms of the state employee contract, and to self-insured groups who make up more than 80% of our membership. I think the context is important. During that 7-year time period, we collected $5 million. During that same time period, we paid dentists in Minnesota $4.05 billion. This is a marginal issue which affects a small number of dentists. 20 dentists were audited last year, 23 the year before, of the 2,800 dentists in our network. Less than 1% a year are subject to audits. Those audits are based on large amount of data that we have. And so we don't think this is the kind of problem that needs legislation, which also goes to this idea that perhaps the parties can work something out. But the context of this, I think, is very important. It's a marginal issue affecting a small number of dentists. The majority of dentists in Minnesota we have great relationships with, and we feel are honest in their claim submission. We think, like in any profession, there are people on the margin that either they're dishonest or maybe they're sloppy with their records or maybe they don't keep good records. But when we audit them, the records don't reflect the necessary information to justify the claim that was submitted. I think the pieces that we've made concessions to or agreement on, number between 10 and 12, we've gone through a number of extensions of notice periods and extensions of time where dentists who are subject to an audit permit them to review the audit results and to come back to us. We've shortened the look-back period or agreed to a shortening of the look-back period. Currently, Minnesota law on contracts has a statute of limitations of 6 years, and on fraud, a two-year look back from the time of discovery. And we've made some agreement, as reflected in the amendment, to a look back of 42 months. It's halfway between 3 years and 4 years, and that shows the kind of give and take that's been subject to some of the discussions. We've been willing to sit down with the dentist since January, since the bill was introduced in January. The first meeting we had was April 14th, when the Senate author, Senator Vandeveer, called a group together. We met for four plus hours yesterday with each other and a lot of other work in between. I know members of the committee have heard from us on this issue, and we appreciate the time that committee members and committee staff have taken to hold our hands through this process. The last piece is on non-covered services, and we think we have agreement on that. Last year, we agreed to similar language, and then the bill was amended in the House to apply only to Delta Dental. We didn't think that was a fair way to go. We didn't think that's a level playing field by any means, and for some of those reasons, that's why the Senate rejected the amended language. This is similar to the language that we agreed to with the Dental Association last year, and we don't oppose the amended language. With that, I'll turn it over to my boss.
Thank you, Mr. Lally. And Mr. Morris, before you speak, I have an announcement for people in the audience. We are not going to be hearing House File 1302, the Representative Kahn bill. She had something else come up, so we're not going to hear that one today. You're all welcome to stay and listen to the other bills, but if that's the only one you're here for, I thought I'd let people know that you can. We're not going to be hearing that one. So thank you. And with that, Mr. Morris, welcome to the committee. And before you start, I'd also like to say, I said this when Mr. Spazzetta was up there speaking for the committee and the author and the temporary author, we very much appreciate everyone on both sides and your willingness to get together and work on this and work towards peace in the valley. So, Mr. Morris, we very much appreciate your appearance here today and yesterday, and thank you. And please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I just want to take a couple minutes. There's been a lot of information floating around about Delta. What is Delta? We're too big, we're too whatever. And I just want to say a few things so that everybody understands and we clear the air. We do not have an 82% market share in Minnesota. I say privately under my breath, I only wish, but we don't. We have about a 40% market share. We also were accused of making audits based on reviewing one chart. That's not true. Now, enough of that. We're here, this controversy exists because, as Joe said, some dentists choose to try to game the system. We have a responsibility under Minnesota law to be a good steward of other people's money. We're a nonprofit health service plan organization under Chapter 62C. We don't have stockholders, we don't pay dividends, we don't have shareholders. We try to keep the cost of the dental benefits cheap in Minnesota as much as we can. Through our foundation efforts, we have contributed $450,000 to the Wilmer Project at Rice Memorial Hospital that provides access for low-income Minnesotans over 3 years. We just renewed that commitment for $175,000. We've also contributed $250,000 to Metro State for the funding of their dental hygiene program. We employ with our contract service provider about 600 people in Minnesota. They are good, well-paying jobs. We have not laid off a single person in the recession. We have about 480 of the employees are located in Eagan, Minnesota. Another 120 are located in the Iron Range in an old abandoned closed IGA grocery store that we leased from the State Department of Economic Development. That's our call center. We do good things. We do what we're supposed to do in Minnesota. We get along with the vast majority of the dentists. But when people want to game the system and they try to take money that they shouldn't, we have a responsibility to act for it. That's what we've done. We think we've done it well. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions anybody might ask.
Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Okay.
Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? I know Ms. Rowan wants to come up and speak briefly. Ms. Rowan, identify yourself for the tape and proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And as I first learned when I took this job 3 years ago, life insurers write dental insurance. I didn't know that, but they do, so here I am. In the Minnesota dental marketplace, which is a very concentrated marketplace, my members are the commercial players that have a very teeny slice of the market. My largest member is MetLife, and they only have 6% of the marketplace. So we are kind of the only competition in this marketplace, and we would really like to stay and play here. As the bill was originally introduced, that would have been very difficult for us. It contained a lot of burdensome requirements that didn't really apply to practices that my members were using. So I want to thank Dominic and the dentist, which kind of sounds like a band, but for working with us and working through those issues. We are about 98% there with the bill as it has been amended. The one issue for us that we're still working on, but we're really close, is that non-covered services issue. We just want to make sure that the limitation is truly on services that are non-covered. So anything within the contract would still be subject to a fee schedule. But cosmetic things, if I want a little diamond in my left incisor or teeth whitening, no fee schedule. And I think we're really close to that with the employer language. So we will continue to work with Dominic and the dentist and the author and the temporary author to bring this to a close.
Thank you, Ms. Ronan. This is working out so well with the temporary offer. Maybe we should just have him continue.
Mr. Chair, can I say one more thing? I almost forgot.
Yes.
I am also here on behalf of Bob Johnson, and the president of the Insurance Federation, who also has a couple of dental insurers in the commercial slice, and he's in the same place that we are.
Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. Members, any questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill as it's currently being worked? With that, seeing no one come down, Representative Atkins, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a couple final words, because one is that I believe, reflective of the efforts so far, there is one additional small change that I would propose as an oral amendment. It is on line 3.3, so obviously on page 3, and where it says 120 days, it should actually be 75 days. That was just an error in the author's amendment I had earlier, and I'd move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Do we need to vote on that, or can you just incorporate that into your...
We already voted on the other one, I think.
Oh, you're right. We do need to vote on that. All those in favor of Representative Atkins' oral amendment on line 3.3 of page 3 of the bill, changing 120 days to 75 days, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Atkins, for catching that.
And the truly final word then, Mr. Chair, is I appreciate on behalf of Representative Davids the efforts that have been made by Dominic and the dentists. I like that line. That sounds really good. But also the Delta folks, Mr. Lally, Mr. McAsey, and to have their chief executive here, I think demonstrates the level of concern that both sides are putting into the bill and the efforts that are being made. With that, I'd move renew my motion that House File 122 as amended be recommended passed and referred to the floor.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. We are, Representative Grunhagen is across the hall. We are going to go grab him. Oh, here he is right now. While we're waiting for him to come down, Representative Lilly, Representative Anderson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, thank you for moving the minutes from April 28th. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Anderson. With that, our next bill, Representative Grunhagen. Please identify yourself and start when you're ready.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Glenn Grunhagen, and today we're bringing forth a bill to address a gap problem as far as affordability coming off group insurance. I just start with a short explanation. Group insurance portability is not a new
Representative Grunhagen, before you get going, I'm going to have Representative Stensrud move the bill so it's properly in front of us.
Okay.
I keep forgetting. I thought you were thinking you're on the committee. I feel very inclusive today. Representative Stensrud, do you want to move House File 1397?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Thank you. Representative Stensrud moves 1397. It's now properly before us. Representative Grunhagen, fire away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Group insurance portability is not a new problem. When group insurance for all-sized employers took off in the early 1970s, Minnesota legislators addressed the problem by requiring insurance companies to offer temporary continuation coverage when an employee, spouse, or child lost their group insurance. In 1973, the Minnesota legislature passed the Minnesota Continuation Law. This law was copied in some form or another in other states. In 1986, the federal government allowed Minnesota's lead and created COBRA continuation for all states to comply with. Today, 25 years since the federal COBRA law was passed, we find that 90% of the individuals do not take this temporary coverage for several reasons. The main reason is affordability. House File 1397, and there's a Senate file counterpart, 1158, the Group Insurance Portability Act allows Minnesota a new opportunity to lead the nation in health care reform. As we have done in the past, it does this by overcoming the primary problem of affordability insurance for newly terminated employees. Taking on a new payment as large or larger than their mortgage payment is quite difficult when you become unemployed. For example, state employees covered under the health insurance plans will face an annual COBRA premium cost in excess of $16,000 per year if you lose your job. And as you know, all of us in a year or so could lose our job. GIP or GAP offers a better alternative than relying on the federal government to solve Minnesota's insurance problems. And I would just say this, I've sold health insurance for over 30 years. And in these last several years, especially the people in the 50 to 64 age bracket, and a lot of those people, some of them are healthy, but many of them have developed health problems. And when they see their COBRA premiums, when they lose their job or for whatever reason, it prevents many of them from, number one, retiring maybe a little earlier, slowing down. They have to pick up another job just to pay their health insurance premiums. And in many cases, they simply can't afford those types of premiums. And what this does is create an additional option. It doesn't take anything away from them that they currently have, but it gives an additional, easily applied option on a guaranteed issue basis. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Greg DeLitto for the minutiae.
Welcome, Mr. DeLitto. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee. My name is Greg DeLitto. I've been insuring the uninsured in this state for over 35 years. One of my firms also is one of Minnesota's oldest COBRA administrator. We administer COBRA for hundreds of employers in the state. I'm also representing the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which includes approximately like 58,000 Minnesota health insurance agents. So we're a coalition here that is right now responsible in insuring 2.4 million Minnesotans, and we give counsel to over 80% of the employers. So the reason that I'm trying to get this bill passed is my colleagues and I have to deal with a broken healthcare system. And, you know, it's hard to argue that it's not broken, but we believe it's fixable. And today we're going to show you two broken parts of the healthcare system that your constituents and also you might not even know about. The insurance companies cannot get together and collaborate to fix this because of antitrust laws. If they all get in the same room, start talking strategy and whatever, what to do, we're told that there's antitrust laws that they can't do. So we have to depend on you to legislate certain things in order for your constituents and even yourself to fix some problems. So, in fact, you'll see in solving a problem, you will also have less people needing government assistance in health care. Because the more people we could insure in the private sector, that means less people you have to pick up on your government programs. So what's problem number one? I believe everybody might have a handout, and I'm actually now on the second page. It says problem one is unaffordable COBRA. Being a COBRA administrator, we know that 1 out of 10 people elect COBRA. 9 out of 10 go without health insurance. Some people say, well, why don't they just go and buy individual insurance? Well, we tried that strategy and to send out individual notices for individual health insurance, and I could tell you that we had zero responses. And the reason being is the individual insurance, there's a 3 to 6 week process just to see if you're going to be covered. It's very complicated, which on here is a whole other issue. But right now you got 1 out of 10 unemployed people that actually elect COBRA. Now, right now in the COBRA premium for you, the Minnesota State Employee Family, you know, if you have family coverage, your COBRA premium is $16,100. So if you have family coverage and you're covered through the state of Minnesota, which is, I believe, the largest pool, and remember, the bigger the pool, suppose you have the lowest rates, you're going to have to pay $16,100 a year for your COBRA if you were to be termed right now. That's unaffordable. That's even higher than another mortgage payment. So that is the problem. Now, individuals that really don't have any health issues or few health issues, they're going to gamble that they're not going to get sick. And those are the people that will eventually come to the state and get health assistance because they just spent down through all their assets down to $3,000. So our whole proposal here is how do we take care of the other 90% of individuals to give them an affordable option? The gap coverage is in between jobs. As Representative Glenn here stated, we're not taking anything away. You still have your COBRA right, but we're going to add another option called gap. It'll fill the gap in while you're in between jobs. This has nothing to do with divorced spouses or widows or anything. This is for terminated employees. The plan is far less cost than the COBRA. It provides immediate coverage to protect against bankruptcy. It's guarantee issue with no pre-existing. And it's simplified enrollment. So the individual will be able to keep the plan only up to 18 months, just like COBRA. So we don't want to have a product where they could stay on forever, because you're going to get what we call anti-selection, and you know, and that's a whole other thing. So we're not going to make it any different than what we currently have under COBRA, but we're going to require that the insurance companies offer 3 low-cost health plans as an option. So if you're already having serious health conditions and you've already met your deductible with your COBRA plan or with your employer plan, most likely you won't take a gap plan. And the reason being is you got to start the deductible over and whatever. So who are probably going to be finding taking this is the healthy population, because it's going to be affordable option, because I believe most individuals that work do not want to go without health insurance, and the only reason they are is because of the affordability. There's some myths going around on what the gap plan is or isn't. And I'm on page 3 here. It will transfer unhealthy risk from employer pools to insurance company. Unhealthy individuals will still elect COBRA, not a gap plan, because of the richer benefits usually in the COBRA plan or the employer plan. And like I said, their deductible has already been met. Another myth is individuals can already buy an individual plan. Okay? Well, I've been doing this 35 years. Cobra Administrator, one of your oldest in the state. I can tell you, people do not go through the process of buying an individual policy when they think it's a temporary problem. Because they're going, oh, I'm only going to be unemployed for, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months. They're not going to go through the through that. And we've tried it to market that, and it hasn't worked.
Mr. DiTillo?
Yes.
I hate to interrupt, but I think the committee has a pretty good idea
yeah,
of insurance
okay.
And things like that. And
Dr.
maybe
Chase?
Well, maybe what we should do is just ask if members do have any questions,
okay.
If that's okay with
sure.
you.
Representative Thank you. Grunig,
members, any questions? Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe to the testifiers. Maybe just step back and just big picture. So we're talking about this gap for all employers and all plans, or is only certain kinds of plans, or is this just something that we're going to make available across the industry?
Yep. Fully insured plans are the only ones you could legislate. Your Target, your 3M, you cannot force them to do this. Okay? So here, I believe the smaller employers who are usually fully insured, they're actually going to use this as a recruiting tool, because now they could tell their new hires or their current employees, we have options now that your large employers don't have. We have an affordable option outside of COBRA. So we're seeing this as a very positive thing for the employer market that should stop the flood of people leaving the fully insured and going self-insured, because it is very attractive.
Thank you, Representative Stenz, for that cover. Representative Grunhagen, do you want to move your amendment now, and we can discuss that?
Sure.
And Representative Stenz, will you move the A-101 amendment?
Yes, I'll move the A-101 amendment.
Yeah, and there were some concerns about certain sections of this bill. One of them would be that benefits for disabled employees. Greg, do you want to say anything towards those concerns?
What we were going to do was mirror the federal law. We were going to treat the small mom-and-pop employers the same as 3M and Target by eliminating some of the current state continuation. But that's something that, being so late in the session, we're saying, let's just take that out.
And Representative Grunie, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the Senate is also okay with this language, and they're going to be good with the changes, and I'm not sure who's going to do it, but they're going to author a
That's
similar
my
amendment.
Understanding. Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you. Members, any questions to the amendment? We'll have Representative Stenz renew his motion for the what did we call it, 101 amendment? The A101 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Do you have any additional comments, Greg?
No, I'm just looking for questions. It's just, you know, not only is it our, you know, our clients, but you also have the same issue that you got a $16,000 option if you have family coverage. And my, you know, recommendation would be is to maybe add it onto your plan also, that you would have an affordable option, because we all have that same problem.
Well, you know, just one final comment, Mr. Chair. You know, having been in insurance, health insurance for as long as I had, these last years when the premiums have gotten to where they are, you know, I've literally had people crying in my office when they look at their COBRA premium, especially in that 50 to 64 age bracket. And that's one of the reasons I bring this bill forward, is they really need to have this easily accessible option that they can go to, and that's what this gives them. It doesn't take anything away from them. It gives them one additional simple option to convert to and continue that coverage for a certain period of time, rather than messing around with underwriting or things such as that nature.
Thank you. And is there anybody that wants to speak against the bill? I'm just looking at one person that I know does. And anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill, please wave your arm or come on down. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica. I'm also here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We certainly understand the concerns that people have, particularly with the affordability of COBRA coverage. As Mr. DeTillo mentioned, the reason COBRA is so expensive, it's basically the full cost of your group coverage, which is generally a much richer benefit than someone would get in the individual market. Our concerns with their attempt to solve this issue is that they're not necessarily producing a solution that's different from what's available in the marketplace, and there's some unintended consequences that are going to occur, particularly on the individual market. And so quickly, let me explain what happens when someone loses coverage. They really do have three options when they lose their group coverage. As Mr. DeTillo mentioned, they can go, if they're healthy, and get an individual policy out in the marketplace. We're seeing more individual policies sold in this marketplace now than we have historically. It's becoming a more robust marketplace. The second option is they can continue their COBRA coverage, but as we mentioned, unless someone who is very ill or has a number of serious health conditions, it's probably looks unaffordable to them. The third option is someone is unhealthy and they want to continue coverage, but they can't afford COBRA. They automatically qualify for coverage under the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. So that's an automatic qualifier for coverage under MSHA. And I think, as this committee knows, MSHA premiums and MSHA products look like products in the individual marketplace. The premiums are capped at 120% of the average market rate for those policies. So it is a coverage option that is more affordable than COBRA. It's certainly a little bit more expensive than what someone would find in the individual marketplace, but that's because the risk pool has greater health conditions in it. I would argue that by establishing these gap products, you're going to have a pricing structure that's pretty similar to MSHA. Because it's a guarantee issue product, we're going to have to price it, assuming that people with greater health conditions are coming into those products and those policies, and therefore we're going to have to price those policies higher than the average individual policy. It's going to look kind of like MSHA. So in essence, I don't know that we're creating a different option than what's currently available for people when they lose their group coverage. My concern in terms of an unintended consequence is that when someone loses their coverage and they go on to COBRA continuation, their risk or their experience stays with the group. So the group's responsible for continuing to pick up the costs of the person who's on COBRA continuation. What this bill would do is would push that experience and that risk into the individual marketplace. And therefore, you're transferring those costs from the group market to the individual market. That might be good for the group market. It's not good for the individual market. And the individual market is a very price-sensitive market where people who are making their own decisions tend to make those decisions based on small fluctuations in the cost of a product. And so while we appreciate what the attempt is here, to solve this issue, we think actually it's recreating a solution that might already be in place. And in essence is providing some unintended consequences, particularly on the individual market. To do so, I want to point out on line 8.1, we're talking again about moving someone, the person, their experience, and their cost from the group market and the group policy to the individual policy, but the bill calls out that the commission stays as a group commission rather than transfer to be an individual commission. And we just think if you're going to move forward and move the people, the commission should be commensurate with the products that they're applying for, not stay with the group if the person, the experience, are moving that way. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barsh. Questions, members? Don't see any. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Next testifier, if you want to come on down. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Robert Commodore with the Department of Commerce. I think with the A1 amendment, which now, as I understand it, only talks about the gap policy, we have less concerns, but we still wanted to talk about the gap policy. We're not sure of the value of that. As mentioned, the person already has COBRA. They have a conversion policy that's available to them. This adds another layer that might be available to people. There's talk about the high cost of the family coverage for the state being $16,000, but there was also talk about the market that they were looking at where the 50 to 64-year-olds, they're not going to have family coverage. The concern that we have right now is that the cost of these gap policies is unknown. We're not sure you know, how they're going to be rated. We're not convinced that they're going to be able to be rated at a price that really is more affordable to this marketplace. So we're just not comfortable with the proposal as it is. There are other health care reform issues going on around the state, and we think it might be better to wait for those to play out. And that's all.
Thank you, Mr. Commodore.
Thank you.
Members, any questions? Anybody else that wants to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Grunhagen, we'll give you the last word.
I'd just like Greg to come forward and respond to some of those concerns that were raised. And go ahead, Greg.
I believe last year the committee actually did pass this, the gap bill. And this year now with state with, worries about the cost, if you take a look at the bill, we're looking at a $15,000 deductible plan. We're looking at a high deductible plan of $5,950, the highest. And the actuarial decrement is anywhere from 60 to 70% lower than a standard COBRA plan. So this thoughts about, well, it's not really needed. Well, to do an individual policy, people don't do it. People, all they want to do is sign a slip of paper that guarantees them with no pre-existing condition some temporary coverage while they're in between jobs. So being a COBRA administrator, you get 1 out of 10 doing it, and they're not buying individual plans.
Thank you, Mr. Cotillo.
With that, I personally believe, having been in the industry as long as I have, that this is a good additional option for people coming off the group. You can't control what an actuary does, and I've had my differences with them over the years, but that's besides the point. The point is, I believe that the pricing should be based on the fact that it's a temporary policy and that it has optional deductibles compared to the group market. Also, there's less mandates on the individual market than there are on the group. It would be a good, positive, and easily accessible option for people when they lose their job, which they're already going through a certain amount of stress and difficulty just losing that job, and allow people, especially in that higher age bracket, a more affordable option. So, members, I'd urge support of the bill. We will continue to talk with the Commerce Committee and the Health Insurance Association there and see if we can resolve some of our differences.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. With that, Representative Stensrud renews his motion that House File 1397, as amended, be passed and moved to the HHS Reform Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. It's going to HHS Reform.
They passed.
Well, we were told this morning that it was going to HHS Reform.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen, why don't we, having voted on the prevailing side, I will move to reconsider it. We can then vote on it again and send it to the floor, and if Representative Gottwalt wants it, we're amenable to having him take it from there.
That's completely agreeable with me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Barsh.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the reason that the Health Reform Committee wanted to see this bill is, although it's amending Statute 62A, which are typically insurance statutes, 62A.16 specifies that this section of law also applies to HMOs, which, although I'd like to change it, are currently regulated by the Department of Health. And so you're amending the regulatory models of the Department of Health, not just the Department of Commerce.
I understand, Mr. Barsh, and that's what we were told this morning, that we needed to send this to HHS Reform. If Representative Gottwalt doesn't need to see it, that's fine. We can, and Representative Atkins and I agree, we'll talk to him on the floor. We're going to send it to the General Register. If he wants it, he can have it, and we will agree with him wholeheartedly. With that, we will move to reconsider the passage of House File 1397. bring it back into the position of our committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We have it back. Representative Stensrud will renew his motion, changed motion, that House File 1397 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. It passes and goes to the General Register. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Fortman. Representative Portman, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1471. And before we even start, we were told that Representative McNamara wants this back. Why, we don't know, but we're going to pass it and send it to the Environment and Energy Finance Committee, whatever they're called these days. With that, Representative Portman, fire away and tell us why we love your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1471 is an initiative brought forward by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it makes some adjustments to the e-waste program that we put in place in 2007. And the e-waste program is a producer responsibility model for dealing with electronic products at the end of their life. And basically the way it works is the government has very little involvement except for to set the goal. The players in the marketplace figure out how to collect the recycling and how to meet the goal. And really the governmental involvement is just a registration fee. The program's been in place for a couple years, and it's become clear that a few amendments are needed to make it operate better. And I'm wondering if everybody has in their packet a handout called Electronics Recycling Act Proposed Amendments, April 2011. And that, just in the shaded areas, hits the three major changes that are in the, I think the three only, or the four only changes that are in the bill. And I have with me here from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Garth Tickle.
Mr. Bill. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to just walk through the proposed changes and then respond to any questions that you may have.
Sir, before you do that, could you spell your last name for us?
Certainly. It's H-I-C-K-L-E.
That's how I told her, but she didn't believe me.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please go on.
The modifications that are before you today resulted from the PCA's evaluation report of the Act. We have a requirement as part of the Minnesota Electronic Recycling Act statute to come back to the legislature on an annual basis with a review and suggested changes to improve the functioning of the Act. And we actually we identified six possible changes in the evaluation report, but decided to move forward with only four after consultation with stakeholders. We did get significant feedback from local government, manufacturers, retailers, recyclers, and others regarding the agency's changes. Modification number one expands the base or the scope of products that are that establish the manufacturer's obligation. As Representative Portman referenced, this is a manufacturer responsibility statute, and it currently applies simply to manufacturers video display devices. So that's laptops, computer monitors, and televisions that are sold to households in Minnesota. This would expand that obligation to address desktop computers, desktop printers, digital video recorders, and DVD players. We premised that modification on a couple issues. One is responding to some of the concerns, particularly from the counties in greater Minnesota, regarding their ability to financially sustain the collection programs that they have implemented. Number two, was really to look for consistency with other states, particularly in the upper Midwest. These are products that are largely obligated under Wisconsin's law, so we feel it's very important to the extent possible that we can help contribute to providing consistency for manufacturers in the available systems. And then lastly is to create more of a level playing field between the products that are being sold into the marketplace. As you're well aware, there's significant innovation and change in the electronics industry, and so for instance, when we started on this with this law, iPads were not in existence. Apple subsequently registered those. We want to make sure that like products are treated fairly. Number two addresses reducing the minimum screen size requirements for video display devices. It is currently at 9 inches or greater. Our proposal is to move that down to 7 inches or greater. Right now, Minnesota is outside of the mainstream of the 25 states that have enacted electronics recycling laws, and this would, again, provide consistency with Wisconsin's law. There's been a significant concern and discussion about what does this mean in terms of additional products beyond what I've already talked about. And based on our analysis that smartphones, cell phones, handheld gaming devices, and so forth would not be subject to the requirements of the program given that they do not have a screen size of 7 inches or greater. That obviously may change at some point in the future, and we will have to revisit that at some point. And then finally, modification number three adds restrictions on the use of recycling credits. The program has been very successful, and there is an opportunity for manufacturers to actually generate recycling credits if they collect over their annual obligation. However, we felt that it was important to actually put some restrictions on the use of those credits to, again, try to incentivize collection, particularly in greater Minnesota. And then lastly, we have suggested just a technical change, which would be moving the obligation setting mechanism from the current year so that manufacturers track how much they collect and sell in the same year to actually changing it so that the manufacturers know going into a program year what their obligation would be. And again, this is similar to how the obligation is determined in Wisconsin. We are currently working with House Research on the specific language changes to implement that change. So I know that was a short overview, but I'd be very happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hickel. Members, any questions? Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I'm curious about, does this impact any Minnesota manufacturers? I don't know that we make these things that are being impacted. If you could fill me in on that, and I'd be curious also, is it mostly out of the U.S. that does this now, or I'm just curious on Mr. the scope of the market?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. Best Buy is currently registered as a manufacturer due to the fact that they do have two private label brands of televisions, and they've actually got substantial market share for those televisions. We do have four other Minnesota-based manufacturers that are already registered for selling either laptops, computer monitors, or televisions, but we do not expect that any other Minnesota manufacturers would be obligated with the expansion of products. Obviously, a lot of these products are manufactured overseas and may have a parent company that is located overseas, but the vast majority of them do have a U.S.-based sales and marketing office at a minimum. So we do have U.S.-based contacts for all of the manufacturers that are registered, with the exception of, I believe, just one or two.
Representative Stensrud, does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the testifier or to Representative Portman. So most consumers are going to bring their electronic stuff to get rid of their e-waste to the retailer when they're going to purchase something new. Is there a requirement that they purchase something new, or can they take it to that retailer regardless for recycling? And then the other question is, you know, our counties, I think most of them have also recycling programs for this. Do you have any idea how the breakdown of collection goes? Is most of it being collected sort of by the retailers and through this e-waste program, or is it by our county recycling programs?
Mr. Hickel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, Best Buy does have a very active collection program at 25 of their locations statewide. They are the single largest entity collecting material in the state at the moment. Their program does not require a purchase for a consumer to be able to drop off the material. There is a $10 charge on cathode ray tube televisions or monitors, but the folks bringing those in are then provided with a $10 gift card. The split between private collection entities and public collection entities is approximately about 50% share of each. Obviously, in greater Minnesota, it's more heavily weighted towards local government-provided effort, just because there are not the number of retailers or other private entities that are providing the service.
Representative Loon. Other questions, members? Representative Hortman, do you have other testifiers that you want to have come down, or is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against the bill?
I think there are some people who want to say something.
Ms. Reinhart, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Victoria Reinhart. I chair the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I'm also chair of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is the six metropolitan counties. And I chair the Environment and Natural Resources Committee for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And so my testimony here this morning is on behalf of both the Coordinating Board and the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I am joined by Lisa Weick, and I'll let you introduce yourself, and then I will go into the testimony.
Thank you. Lisa Weick, last name is W-E-I-K, Washington County Commissioner, District 5, most of Woodbury. We did open a new environmental center last year, so I'm here to talk to that briefly. I've been on the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board for 2 years, and I've been a commissioner for 2.5.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. We are, the Coordinating Board and the Association of Minnesota Counties is very supportive of the current law, and in fact trying to do some tweaks, as you have heard, as far as the current law that really is about product stewardship, and that's the private sector taking responsibility for recycling electronics. Under product stewardship, the manufacturer is responsible for recycling a certain percentage of what they actually sell in Minnesota. And to me, this is the private sector working at its best. Unfortunately, the application of the law that we had that is currently in place, because we are such avid recyclers in Minnesota, we had great success, but there were a number of credits that were allowed to be carried over, and so basically within the first year, you had enough credits that the manufacturers really didn't have to step up to the plate and deal with this, and much of this, especially in greater Minnesota, the cost fell to counties. The reason for that is because even though there is a multiplier in place to encourage recycling in greater Minnesota, it truly wasn't enough if you've got the manufacturers already getting all of their credits, everything that they need out of the metro area. That still wasn't enough of an incentive because the credits were already in place. And because in greater Minnesota, also the problem with these things ending up in the woods or in the ditches is truly an environmental hazard, but also one that is not good for our natural environment and for tourism. And so the counties did feel that they needed to step up to the plate and provide this service, and obviously at a cost to their residents, which really should be, under a true product stewardship model, be borne by the manufacturer. The amendments that are before you today are really to try to address these concerns, not not only in Greater Minnesota but in the metro area as well. The need for the amendments, again, is partly due to the original recycling rates really being set too low so that the credits were achieved very, very early. I did think it was interesting to note that Best Buy, our partner in the original legislation, tells us that Minnesotans per capita recycle more than residents in any other state. So I guess we should be very, very proud of that. But again, because of that, it's also the carry forward credits in particular have brought us some issues that we need to try to deal with. We do know that that the amendments that you're looking at today are consistent with other states. Specifically, Wisconsin has many of the changes, and we're trying to assure the consistency with Wisconsin laws. The most controversial of the changes are those needed the most by the counties to address this surplus of credits. To do this, the amendment proposes increasing the obligation to recycle to include such things as printers, computers, VCR, and DVD players, and to sunset the credits after 3 years. Both of these changes are not inconsistent with other states' program, and together should increase service and recycling by manufacturers throughout Minnesota, consistent with the concept that manufacturers should be responsible for what they develop and sell, and the burden for management upon disposal should not be at the cost of local government. And again, I would like to thank you for your support, and would really hope that you would vote in favor of these. To me, product stewardship is the private sector at its best, the manufacturer being responsible for the cost of recycling these items and not having that burden placed on government. Thank you.
Ms. Reiner.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
To add to that, in Woodbury, Washington County did open a new environmental center about a year ago, and on the first day that we were open, we collected 2 semi-trailers full of electronics devices. So that's great for the environment. Our citizens are doing the right thing. We're diverting that, protecting our groundwater. However, that is, again, subsidized by Washington County. So I would urge the committee to support this. I think these changes should reduce local government and taxpayers' cost of managing electronics and create the business environment where the manufacturers are responsible for the products. And the consumers that are purchasing these items, these are discretionary purchases. I hate to see real estate owners in our county, maybe senior citizens that maybe aren't out buying the iPads or the computers or actually then subsidizing some of these costs. In Washington County, in 2009, the amount of money not recovered, and so borne by Washington County, was over $91,000. 1 year later, then in 2010, the costs not recovered were over $154,000. So again, a sizable jump. If that continues to climb, right now there is no additional cost if you come to the Environmental Center in Woodbury to drop off recyclables. Your driver's license is scanned. There's reciprocity in the Twin Cities area. However, we would likely have to charge a fee. If we do that, I'm afraid that some consumers may not do the right thing, and this could end up then out into the environment. So that was what I wanted to come to add, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both. And I am sort of a selective listener, and what I got out of all that is I should bring my recycling things to Ramsey County. Thank you. Representative Hortman, do you have anyone else? Members, any questions? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank my commissioner for coming here today to testify, and I'm her representative. Yeah. Thank you.
Come on now. Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill, please come forward. Please identify yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Waste Management. We're the largest recycler and trash collector in the state. We operate out of a materials recovery facility, or MRF, over in Minneapolis. That collects about 250,000 tons per year of recyclable commodity. We've been recycling e-waste for about 15 years, well ahead of the 2007 legislation that passed. We were involved in the development of that legislation with PCA and the counties, and we've worked together to make this program work. We are a private business. We operate both in the state and nationally. We have e-waste depots throughout the state. We have about 20 of those that feed into our Twin Cities recycling facility. The 2007 legislation may seem to have been ahead of the curve, but that's where we're at today. That's the direction of business and commerce. That's what we're seeing, is that we have major corporations, major retailers that have established sustainability policies, zero waste policies, and our national company, Fortune 200 company, has had to respond to some of those major retailers, major businesses that are demanding changes in the way that products are manufactured, how they're handled, and recovered. So that's the direction that we're headed in. Our company is going through a transformation in response to that. Our materials recovery in the Twin Cities is responding to that as well by offering e-waste recycling, but lamp recycling, appliance recycling, and anything in the future that we determine has value will also be recovered at that facility. Computers have precious metals. They do have value. While they also pose a management issue as far as making sure they're managed appropriately, they do have precious metals that do need to be recovered. And we have end markets both regionally and globally, primarily regionally. So a lot of those circuit boards, components, glass, the CRT portion, they are recovered here in the U.S. But we've recovered a lot of material, more than double than what we ever expected to, with the projections that were done by the PCA. So we do need to make adjustments in the legislation. We support those changes that are being proposed here today that change those definitions. Because it does create more demand. Right now we have an oversupply of computers coming in, and we need to make adjustments to ensure that the business part, the business recycling part of the equation for us still makes sense. So I urge you to support this bill and vote in favor of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ketchum. Please identify yourself with the tape and start whenever ready.
Hi, I'm Teresa Bauer. I'm here representing Materials Processing Corporation. We're also an electronics recycler. We operate out of Mendota Heights, Minnesota, and we process in excess of 12 million pounds for the legislative programs in Minnesota. Our business has benefited greatly from the existing law already. Over the last year and a half, we've been able to provide an additional 100-plus jobs to Minnesota citizens. Additionally, we have been able to double the size of our facility. Some of the suggested revisions of the bill would only further promote our business growth and potentially add more jobs in the state. And also the addition of the scope, or the expansion of the scope of the devices, would be able to cover some of the operating costs we have, as our company's principles would say such that we wouldn't turn away any types of materials coming into these collection facilities. We just go ahead and take everything, whether we get compensated or not. And that would further promote responsible recycling, and then those savings would also be able to filter down to the municipalities, the counties, cover some of their costs as well.
Sounds good. Thank you. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, and just briefly, I just wanted to know if at some point, Representative Hortman, I kind of have a sense that when this was put in place, there was everybody cleaning out their basements and their attics of all of this old equipment. And if that starts to taper down, are we going to come back then and readjust the credits at that point?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would presume, yes, that if the
the industry finds that at a certain point they can't meet the goal that's out there, that they would come in and ask for a change to be made. I think the good thing about one of the changes is looking at the past year sales, so that should track pretty well the need going forward.
Representative Anderson?
And Representative Hortman, you would support that adjustment then?
Representative Hortman?
Yes, I would expect it. I would support that.
Thank you. Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, is Apple tracking this junk?
Representative Hortman?
I'm sorry, I must have missed the first part. Apple?
Aren't they the ones that are, you know, they can tell where I'm at any given time based on me carrying my iPad around?
Oh, sorry, I wasn't paying attention.
Will they know where all this stuff is? Never mind.
Representative Hortman, we'll give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, I hope that you'll pass the bill.
We like that final word. That's good. That's very concise. We like that. With that, I will renew my motion to House File 1471 be passed and sent back to the Environment Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, members. Thank you, Representative Hortman. Members, thank you. It's been a long week. I'm glad we're done with it. It's been a fun week, but I'm still glad we're done with it. Have a good weekend. We are adjourned.